And all of those kids were, they weren't real big punchers before, but they became that because of the explosiveness. And that's what it is, turning on them. And once again, you have to rotate the ball to the foot and get that explosiveness going and turn the body. And that's where it's at. They were above the rest, and you could see that. You know, you could see the difference in people sometimes, and you knew that these guys, and plus they went to the next level, and they were not goofballs. They were guys that got in there and worked hard and drove themselves to be the best. And I think that's what it's all about. That's the difference between a winner and a loser, you know? And because I was known as a disciplinarian, and I was, but I learned that from a guy named Pat Nappy, Pennsylvania. Pat Nappy was a strong, strong disciplinarian, and that's where I learned it from him, you know. And but you had to be hardcore sometimes, and you had to say things and do things, and people don't like. But hey, you're trying to do the best thing that's for him.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oleg was child's play compared to that one?
Still a goosebumps to this day.
Just, you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beaten me. He said, well, let's pull him back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
Hello, welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week I'm joined by the wonderful Kenny Adams, who was born in September 25, 1940. He's a famous and well-renowned American coach who's worked with the likes of Edwin Valero, Vince Phillips, Diego Corrales, and many, many more. On top of that, he's a Vietnam veteran who coached the American Olympic teams in 1984 and 1988, so teams that included the likes of Pernell Whitaker, Evander Holyfield, Roy Jones, Ray Mercer, Meldrick Taylor, countless others. Huge names, great fighters. And there are some sources out there that says he's trained 26 world champions, 34 Olympians, and 56 fighters who have gone on to become world champion. Truly outstanding credentials, and it was wonderful to get the chance to speak to Kenny recently. The time just shot by, and I was delighted to talk to him about all manner of things. I was obviously particularly captivated about his service in Vietnam and his take on Muhammad Ali's stance, and I found Kenny brilliant company and was thoroughly engaged throughout our chat. Huge thanks, before I leave you with Kenny, to my sponsors Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance. They're a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. While I have you guys, and before I pass you on to Kenny, if you can possibly rate and review this podcast where you listen to it, it would be hugely appreciated. Share links and spread the word. I'm enormously grateful. And I'm delighted to say that I'm actually being partnered by Roots of Fight for the next few weeks. Roots of Fight, who are a wonderful clothing brand, one of the best or the best in boxing. I've supported Roots of Fight from day one, and they've been following the podcast since day one. And it's really good to be able to team up with them. So I do have giveaways for the next few weeks. This week I'm giving away a Rocky Marciano Army Boxing Olive t-shirt in a medium. To win this t-shirt, you need to message me on across any social media platform or email. You need to mention my handle at Tris Dixon. You need to say the words Kenny Adams or write the words Kenny Adams. And you need to say what two fighters there are in this world that Kenny Adams says several times in this podcast. What two fighters, what two types of fighters are there in this world? And that's with for your chance to win a vintage olive Rocky Marciano Army Boxing t-shirt from my friends at Roots of Fight. Without further ado, here's Kenny Adams.
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
I love the Army Ranger cap that you're wearing. How long have you had that for?
Oh, I mean, I went to Ranger School in 1962. Long, long time ago. I got out of service in 1988.
What was that experience like, going through Ranger School? How tough was that? Because we've heard the stories.
It was tough. Ranger School was very, very tough. But, you know, physically, mentally, it was okay because my secondary thing that I did, first thing I did then, I was a boxer, and that didn't affect me at all. So it was not a big thing for me because lean, mean, tough, that's what you got to be that.
And also, like, you, life had been kind of difficult for you in many respects as well, right, before that. So you'd kind of, like, had some hardships and experienced adversity even before you joined Ranger School, right?
No, I was in the 101st Airborne Division, a great unit, is in 187. And I had been through a lot of the training because, actually, before I went to Ranger School, I had been to Recondo School. So that was a good help for me because it kind of gave me the Ronnie Condo was kind of a junior ranger thing. So it wasn't a big thing. Now, mindset is what this is all about, really and truly.
Were there many black guys in Ranger School?
Huh?
Were there many black guys in Ranger School?
There was a few, yes. There was a few black guys there, yes. Yeah,
because I've read,
well, obviously not a whole bunch, but quite a few. But maybe about Ranger School when I went through was probably about five or six, which is not a lot really considering.
Sure, because I've read in doing my research, Kenny, about you being a pioneer in many respects, certainly in terms of boxing and the work that you did on the Olympic teams and that kind of stuff that you must look back on very proudly.
Yeah, I am very proud of it. You know, it's a nice setting and outing per se, because like this is what I've done most of my life. I started boxing when I was like about 10 years old. So, and I kind of did all this on my own too, you know, although my uncle was a valedictorian, which is a guy that goes out and fights for money and stuff like that, you know. And so I got involved with that and it just learned me some lessons about things to do, you know. So, and that's what I wanted to do. And it so happens that as soon as I got into the military, I went to Fort Carson, Colorado for my second 8 weeks. But in my first 8 weeks in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, they had a boxing show at one of the base there, at one of the companies, and I got involved in that. And then when I got to Fort Carson, I did it again, and I said, "Oh, so they can do this in the Army." So that's where I learned, really started doing it, and I got with the teams and stuff then, and that was it, man. I got taken.
And is this right? In the amateurs, people called you Little Sugar. Is that right?
Yeah, because the nickname was given to me because I kind of had a style like Sugar Ray Robinson.
So, and if you're going to have a style like anyone, that would be the style you want, right?
Yes, for sure. Definitely that. Yeah, you're definitely right.
Before we drill down to the boxing stuff, obviously, you went to Vietnam as well, right?
Yes, I did. 68, 69.
So tell me what that was like. Is that as horrific as we would all imagine it would be?
Yeah, it was kind of tough in a sense, but I was with a good outfit, the 101st Airborne Division. The main thing is that stay alert, stay alive. And that was a good motto to have. Because you had to deal with the enemy like that. And you go up in the mountainous areas and in the jungle areas. And yeah, it was a little to be thought about because, I mean, a lot of people got hurt there, injured. So Yeah. Plus, I worked with a 5-man team. I was a Ranger, and before that, I was a Recondo at the 101st Airborne Division, and it was a lot to be seen that way because there was a lot of hard work involved in that very mindset, and it was really, you had to be on the ball there, you know. So you work in 5-man teams, you go behind the enemy lines. So that made you stay alert and stay alive.
You must have lost quite a few friends out there, right?
Yeah, I did. Lost a lot of friends, yes.
And political, yeah, sorry, you go on, Kenny.
No, that's okay. That's what I was going to say, but not as many as I had really met because, unfortunately, or fortunate enough, put it this way, when you join the military like that and you go to different locations, you're not around the same people that you grew up with in the military, such as you went through basic with, you went through AIT with, and you're in the same company with. The only thing is, the company you got with was the one that you stayed with, which was good. But once again, I work with a 5-man team. We go behind the enemy lines. We were 5-man teamers, you know, so only 5 people would go. And we would jump behind enemy lines and things of that nature.
And Kenny, I mean, that's just terrifying to hear, right? So you'd be behind enemy lines, 5 of you, and basically you'd be going to villages and places where there could be entire squads of enemies.
Well, that's why you had to be very diligent to what you did as far as what you really did. You must pay attention to your left and your right because, man, one mistake and it's all over. You know, so that's what you're the 5-man team. We went behind enemy lines. We would get – our job was to get the particulars that they were doing to see what they were up to and call in artillery on them and things of that nature. So that's what we did. We 5-man team was really a good group to be in because they were very excelled, man. I mean, you had to be on your P's and Q's. So, you know, it, rather than being with a company where you were a company where you got 30 or 40 people in a company and they can hear you, but behind the enemy lines like that, you was on your own. You had to be P's and Q's, man.
You must have danced with death many times then.
Yeah, it was quite a few times, but like I said, the sign goes, stay alert, stay alive.
Gosh, you're not wrong.
But two types of fighters, that's the quick and the dead, and you got to be the quick. Yeah.
So let me ask you 2 things on this. What was your view on Muhammad Ali's stance about Vietnam?
I'm just a big Muhammad Ali fan. I don't have any big things that I like to say would say bad about it because I met him before and we hooked up and we got along very well. I met at the Hall of Fame. And at first I didn't like it. No, exactly that. I was like, what does he think he's doing? Not going to the Army, he's in our country and he's not going in the service. And until, you know, people, we sat down and talked about it and started doing things. And I started thinking a lot of things, a lot of different things. You know, that was his theory. He didn't believe in doing that. And I can't take away something that he wants, you know. So, and since he's one of my idols, I had to take it in the stride, man, you know, and say, well, hey, I took his spot, no problem.
That's a good way of looking at it, Kenny. Let me ask you this. You know, people talk now to when they're with veterans about people struggling with PTSD. Has that been a thing that you had post Vietnam?
Yeah, I have PTSD also somewhat. It's called anger management, sort of, but I've gotten through it real well. Without, I mean, P- people don't think I don't act that way at all, because I think boxing has been a sense of been a helper for me, and being an athlete per se, I think you get to take it out on somebody, or you will get to a point where you say, hey, there were two types of fighters, the quick and the dead. I'm the quick. You know, there it is.
And I mean, in terms of the quick and the dead, there's also the quick and there's the strong in there somewhere as well, because I read somewhere that you were the first guy to implement strength training, certainly into the national team.
Okay, put it this way. I wasn't the first guy. I was the first guy in the States to do this, but I learned it from the German camp in Sonthofen, Germany, when I went to one of the training camps, and that's where I learned strength and conditioning, which I found to be a very explosive. And it's for power and explosiveness on your punching, and it gives you a lot of endurance and stamina also, which is good about. So that's what I learned it at. And I learned it from actually the Bundeswehr, which are, they go behind the enemy lines. That's what they did in Germany, in Sonthofen, Germany, is where I picked that up at. And I went there with a team, and I learned it from them, because they showed me a lot about conditioning that I didn't know before. And when I learned that and the different movements and things that they did, I could see why they were very strength. They called it strength and conditioning.
Yeah, because I read that with your amateur team, you went over there and beat the Germans, and then they invited you over so you could trade training tips and see how, yes, basically, so they wanted to see what you did that allowed you to beat them, but you were like, oh, well, we could maybe take some stuff from them too.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what happened. Up in Sonthofen, that was where the Bavarian camp was at. That's where I saw their strength and conditioning. I thought, oh, something I can steal, and I got that, because, you know, Americans, boxers and stuff are very natural in what they do. And so, therefore, that was our styling and everything is a little different from everybody else's. But then there's a lot of people that can do it. But we do it in the sense that we did a lot of strengthening and things that really helped a lot. But, man, that was a blessing for me to learn that strength and conditioning, because United States was not doing that then, and it really was a plus. It really was a plus.
So this, what we're talking about is stuff that you would implement through the 70s. I mean, I remember when Evander moved up from cruiserweight to heavyweight, and everyone was saying that was the first time they'd seen strength training. You've been doing it 15, 20 years by then.
Yes, well, that's where it's at. You know, it puts more muscle tone on you, and then it causes you to use your muscles much more, and also for speeding, sprinting, and conditioning, because you mix running and you mix your weights, but you don't use heavier weights. You use small weights with a lot of repetition.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's fascinating to look back at this and to realize you were doing this. Because I remember, you remember the old Philadelphia light heavyweight called Harold Johnson. Do you remember him?
Yes. Yeah, I remember Harold Johnson, yes.
So I remember interviewing Harold many years ago now. And I said to Harold, because he had a fabulous physique, I said, mm-hmm. did you used to use weights? And he was almost insulted by the idea of using weights, because like you said, it was probably a very natural mover and everything came to him, you know, very fluidly. And he was insulted by being linked to doing weights. But like you said, it's progressive.
It's not heavy weights. See, that's what people don't, it's not heavy. It's small weights for a lot of reps.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I understand that. And also, I mean, it goes into another thing, which I'm always interested in. When you look at a puncher like a Tommy Hearns, you know, people say this is natural stuff, but can you make someone a puncher with doing this or by adding things to their toolbox through weights? Would you just make them better than that?
Yeah. You can teach a guy explosiveness, turning on the balls of the feet, rotating your body in such a manner that where you get your explosiveness out of the turning on the balls of the foot. toll, and also that's what the strength and conditioning did also. It gave you that explosiveness. That's what that did.
And in terms of your fighters, Diego Corrales is a good example of that, right? Someone who you managed to get to increase his power.
Yeah, increase his power. Him, Eddie Cook, Vince Phillips, Kennedy McKinney, all of those kids weren't real big punchers before, but they became that because of the explosiveness, and that's what it is, turning on the – and once again, you have to rotate the ball of the foot and get that explosiveness going and turn the body, and that's where it's at.
So the 1984 Olympic team with Pernell Whitaker, Evander, Meldrick Taylor, Virgil Hall, those guys, that was one of the great teams. And you were involved with that, right?
Yes. Assistant coach, yes.
How did that opportunity come about?
It came about because Pat Nappy, who was an older gentleman, so many of those fighters, they really like to do the mitts for explosiveness and power and everything. And they were looking for something, a younger mold. But once again, it came about, I think, because my teams were winning the national tournaments. Are we doing very well at the national tournament? My boxers were doing well at the tournaments. And so therefore, let's look at this guy, see what he's doing that other people are not doing, and maybe we'll get a good. So that's what happened there. They came around and saw some things that I was doing, and those were things they wanted to implement and put into the drills and everything, such as runs and things of that nature. And so it so happens. And then Pat Nappy knew me. I was one of his boxers years ago when I was in the Army. I was fought at 112 and 119. I was one of his boxers, and he knew me. And he knew I was kind of a disciplinarian in a sense, and yet still I had my act together. So he said, yeah. And I was winning, too. That's another thing. My teams were winning the Nationals and the Forces Command Championship, the All-Service Championships and everything. So they give me a plus, too. So, and my guys were good enough. They were doing that. So what happened was I got blessed on that, you know, and through other people, you know.
Did you realize that you were dealing with special fighters in Evander Holyfield, Whitaker, Meldrick, and all and that? Did you realize that they all could go on to achieve massive things and be famous and that?
You could see that. Oh, yes. Without a doubt. You knew that. These guys were very explosive. And in a sense, they were doing conditioned and strength in a sense that they took to another level also. So I think, yes, without a doubt. All of those kids were amazing, really and truly.
But in terms of where they got to, as in, you know, we're talking about several Hall of Famers as well. Did you think that they would be all-time greats? I mean, it's one thing thinking they can transition well to the pros. It's another thing when you think that they're that special.
Yes, I think so. I did. I knew they were going to be great, outstanding in a sense that you would know that, yes. You could see their explosiveness, their ability, how they, even the things that they did as far as their drills were concerned, they were above the rest, and you could see that. You know, you could see the difference in people sometimes, and you knew that these guys, and plus they went to the next level, and they were not goofballs. They were guys that got in there and worked hard and drove themselves to be the best. And I think that's what it's all about. That's the difference between a winner and a loser, you know?
And you had another top team in 88 with the likes of Ray Mercer, Riddick Bowe, obviously Roy Jones, Michael Carbajal. It wasn't quite history repeating itself, but geez, it's another incredible class of Olympians, right?
Yeah, once again, time somewhat had changed a little bit then, but the explosiveness that all these guys showed, and then when we went to camp, that was a very, very important thing. And we got to be in a camp, which was very good, which was Colorado Springs. That's a blessing place to be, and you could do your explosiveness and do a lot of things in. And I kind of interjected a lot of my training during that time frame, and each one of those guys were people that kind of fell into it, because these guys were more explosive people. They were rhythmic guys and et cetera. And it made a big difference. And plus they listened and just made a great team behind that, you know?
One of them was Ray Mercer, who was also a military man. Did that make you two closer?
Well, no, you know, once again, Ray and I, we had closeness because he was on the Army team and I was an Army coach. So I knew basically what he was about, but Ray moved to another level too. And all of these guys did, even those that were not military oriented or whatever, they still moved to the next level, because all those guys looking for one thing and to get that goal, you know what I mean? And they pushed to the next level.
One who didn't get the gold was Roy Jones. I mean, you were obviously there when he didn't get that decision. Was that as bad as any decision that you've seen?
That's as bad as any decision I've seen, because I tell you, I almost got kicked out of that, because I was getting ready to crack me somebody. I was getting ready to go crack them judges. I looked and saw who went out and walked over, and I remember Mr. Hull was one of them. He said, Kenny, no. I said, okay. I said, oh, man, that was just terrible. I mean, it was stinky.
Were you more angry or were you sad for Roy? What was your overcoming emotion?
I had both things, because I felt bad about him. Here, he's a great fighter that they just took his medal is what they did. They just took it. So, hey, we ain't going to give it to you. And no, that was just a terrible matter in a way. And it wasn't no if, and, buts. I mean, that was clear cut. You know, it was real. But, you know, that wasn't the only, there were other things that happened in that camp. They did so many different things to try to sideline us, man. I'm talking about such as not having a bus at an area we were supposed to be in at, to catch a bus to go to another area. They didn't get a bus there on time. A lot of things happened that wasn't even talked about in that place, man. And I tell you, man, there's about to be some uproar going on there. They really treat us like animals. They did.
And I mean, they kind of admitted that they got it wrong with Roy, didn't they? Because they gave him the Val Barker Award for being the best boxer when he even got the silver. They knew,
yeah,
right?
They didn't even know. Val Barker means the best boxer, supposed to be the best boxer there. So he loses and they give it to him. Yeah, you're right. Exactly. But he deserved it.
So in 1989, I understand you meet with Bob Arum, who talks to you about training pros. And in fact, it's not just Bob, but there's Akbar Muhammad and a couple of others. And are they trying to get coax you out of the amateur game and say, look, come here and train some pros for us? Is that how it goes?
Yeah. I mean, that's what happened. They came and asked me what I would like to change the professionals. And at the same time, once again, you know, and I know they're probably hearing me say this, but it's the truth. They knew that if I came along with them, then the fighters, some of them, would come along with me. And that is what happened.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, in terms of that, was it a financially tempting thing, or was, you know, given what you've said about the 1988 Olympics, were you fed up with the amateur politics and done with it?
Yes, I was fed up with it because of the politics they played in the games. But I guess it wasn't about whether I got paid or not, but I love to get paid, though. I love money. So it all plays a good role in it, though. Yes. And another thing, knowing too, that being with Top Rank, that Bob Arum and his group with Akbar Muhammad and all those different people, it was it's a sense of knowing you with good people that really know their business, you know. So that was always a blessing. Yeah, definitely.
And what was it that made you a good trainer who could transition from the amateurs to the pros? Was it the way that you did the military background help, and did your own upbringing help?
Yes, it did help. The military background helped in a sense. My upbringing also was another thing. I grew up, my mom didn't play. I got whooped with razor straps and ironing cards. You understand me? Come here, boy. Drop them pants. Yes, look here. And so I grew up being tough, lean, and mean. I grew up in a club atmosphere where my aunt and uncle who raised me, they owned it. And so, you know, yeah, it was something, man. I grew up tough. It was tough.
And I mean, it's hard for people like me to compute what this was like, but some of the areas that you grew up in were still segregated, right?
Yes, they were segregated. But you know something? This also was one of the reasons that my aunt had me in a Catholic school. I grew up a Protestant guy before, per se, and I finally changed over and became a Catholic. But to tell you the truth, the nuns were very tough. And the nun might have been the very person that really started me into boxing, because she didn't like fighting and stuff. And so I got into a fight. And you know what she had me do? She had me go out into the cloakroom and hit the wall with my fist. You like to fight? Here, hit this wall. Man, you know, I just think about that. You know, that probably was another lesson for me. Hey, this is what I want to do.
Just without the wall being there.
Yeah. I never forget the one sister's name. She's about 6 foot tall, thin lady, and Sister Dionysia. Oh, that sister didn't play. Hit this wall, boy. You like to hit stuff? Hit that wall. Oh, she hit me, hit that wall. Yes, I'll never forget her.
Do you know, when we touched upon segregation there, by the way, does that make you resentful for having to experience that? Because obviously it's a different time now and a different era, but it still exists.
I don't know if it made me angry about a time frame. You know, we didn't like it and it wasn't good, but you know, you put yourself through life and you take things and you take it and you leave it, but it's just people that you're involved with and you're around sometimes. And they weren't all black people. They were white people and Mexican, et cetera, that I have friends with. You know, and I think a lot of that has a lot to be with it. You know, you accept people for what they are, you know, and that's what you have to do, you know. So, there were certain people, some people that would move it to the next level, which was wrong. Yes, definitely. But, you know, you just got to live with it. And only the strong survive, or we fall by the wayside. Hey, but two types of fighters, the quick and the dead. You got to be quick. Amen.
So you said, obviously, that you might be able to coax some of this top amateur talent to go pro. Some of the early ones that you had were, obviously, the triple threat, right? Ray Mercer, Charles Murray, and Al Ice Cole. They were three of the first guys that you were working with as pros, weren't they? Like, they were some of the early guys.
Yes.
That's not a bad crop to have.
And quite a few other ones that I work with, you know, Eddie Cook and Vince Phillips, quite a few other guys. But the thing is that I've always had an eye, thought about it, and my goal was to make sure a guy was disciplined. Make sure he did the right things, because there were two types of fighters. Like, once again, there's only quick and the dead, you know, and you got to be quick. But the thing is that you have to have discipline, and that has to be understood. Without that, there's nothing.
Which is interesting, given some of the guys that you will later train, but we'll get to that. You've had some, like 20, 30 world champs. You know exactly how many that you've worked with?
About 20-some, maybe. Yeah, 20-some, I think, something like that.
Do you remember the first one?
My first world champion. Oh, boy. Oh, my goodness. Oh. Let me see. Boy, boy.
Do you need a clue? Do you want a clue?
You give me a clue.
He fought Don Curry.
Still don't have him in mind.
Frenchman.
Oh, we're an age of cold. My goodness. From France. Oh, yes. That was my, oh, man, yeah. Oh, I had forgotten about the kid. Yeah, Rene Jacob. My goodness, yes. Yeah, I went to France and trained him and brought him back to the States. And we gave Donald a lesson. And then you talk about discipline. Once again, we talk about people from different countrymen like this. These guys didn't have a problem with discipline. They were very disciplined in a sense. And that was good. And that kid was that way. Rene Jacob, yes.
So that Ring magazine called that the upset of the year, like that he wasn't expected to win that.
Right, yeah, Donald was. I trained Donald later on in my career too. Yeah, Donald was super fast. Him and Sugar Ray Leonard, they were very sharp, tough, lean and mean.
And you've obviously had many upset wins, but another big win that you had was when Vince Phillips beat Kostya Szyu, and I think that was one that you were particularly proud of, right?
Yeah, because I had kind of predicted that was going to happen, and I had seen Kostya Szyu and saw them train and work out, and I knew Vince was the perfect guy to beat him because he did the key thing, which he couldn't deal with at that time. Pressure, pressure, pressure. But, yes, Kostya Szyu was one heck of a fighter, that he was. And I ended up going to his country, training some of his guys, too, during that time frame. And that was very good.
What you saw was what I think Ricky Hatton would do something differently against Kostya Szyu, but they knew that the power was in the right hand. And what Ricky did to navigate that power was to make sure that he was never on the end of that right hand, and he was always in a punching distance, so he couldn't fully extend the right hand. But what you did with Vince was get him moving to Vince's right, away from the right hand, right? So that he was always moving one way and Kostya couldn't get set.
Right. Made a lot more sense to do that, to move away from his power. So why would you want to go to his power, and at the same time, it doesn't make sense because you could get hurt, and more than likely, Kostya Szyu could punch.
But you also had a lot of faith in Vince's chin as well, right? He was one of the hardest-headed guys that you'd had.
Yes, I did. He was very tough, lean and mean. Yes. Yeah, I did have confidence in it. Yes.
Tell me about Eddie Cook. We don't hear a lot about Eddie Cook these days. So tell me a bit about him and your relationship with him.
The relationship with Eddie was good. Eddie was a very strong, strong puncher. He had a big left hand and a hard worker. And most of these guys were hard workers. That's the one thing. And plus, the point is, I'm a disciplinarian, and being a disciplinarian, I like to put guys in that level, such as you have bed checks. We get up and we run. We all go to the gym. We do our thing there. And so everything has to be progressed in the sense that make a move to the next level. And that's what Vince was. But Vince was very hardcore. Vince was tough, lean, and mean. And I think he was hungry too. And that plays a big role in a lot of boxes. You got to be hungry.
Did you have a favorite night with Eddie Cook?
Favorite night?
Yeah, as in a favorite fight.
I hate to even try to ever do that because when you do that, you leave somebody out. and you hurt some people. You get their feelings hurt. And I don't like to do that. So I always put it this way. Only the strong survive, the weak fall by the wayside. Ain't but two types of fighters, the quick and the dead. All my fighters were quick.
Okay. I know you said about Kennedy McKinney, by the way. He's a guy who...
He was definitely above the rest in a sense that Starling is what he had. He really had it. He had reach, power, speed, endurance, stamina. He had, but then I could go to Vince Phillips, I could get the same thing. I go to Eddie Cook, I get the same thing. I go to Ray Mercer, I get the same thing. You know, a lot of different fighters, you could pull that out of them and get the same particulars that you would have with those guys. But some guys just take it to the next level, you know? And I think that's all the big difference in the world is that taking it to the next level. And, you know, another thing is these guys are very disciplined, and because I'm a disciplinarian per se. And that was a good thing for them. And, you know, and you're not that you're trying to run them, but you're trying to make sure that they're prepared for the next step. And, hey, man, it's life is that way, man. You know, it's and that's why my motto used to be only two types of fighters, the quick and the dead, and you've got to be quick.
So with regards to Kennedy, why doesn't he get his flowers the way that perhaps he deserves now that we're a few years on? Because, he, you know, people do skim over his career unfairly sometimes.
Yeah. I think it's because, unfortunately, it's the drugs. You hate to think that, but that's the way people look at it. But, you know, he overcome that, came the champion that he wanted to be. Hey, you got to forgive and forget.
Yeah. In terms of what was because you would have known Kennedy well. So what was he? Why did he go down that route? Is it just temptation that fighters at the top get, or were you pushing him too hard and he needed to relax and wanted to go? He didn't like the discipline and he was rebelling against it. Do you know why he went down that route?
You know, I guess it's something that people have. You know, they have different stroke for different folks. And I guess he wasn't the only one. There was quite a few other people that dealt with drugs. And but the thing is, you know, the major thing is getting caught, you know. And that's why I always tested. I started testing people, what I would do once a week. And they never know when. I would test them, have it urinated, and have it checked. See if they've been dealing with it, you know. So you have to protect your people too. You know, that's what you have to try to do. And moving to the next level, once again, have bed checks and things of that nature. And because I was known as a disciplinarian, and I was, but I learned that from a guy named Pat Nappy in Pennsylvania. Pat Nappy was a strong, strong disciplinarian. And that's where I learned it from him, you know. And but you had to be hardcore sometimes. And you had to say things and do things and people don't like. But, hey, you're trying to do the best thing is for him. And in the long range, paid off.
Do you worry that performance-enhancing drugs have become a big thing in boxing?
Yeah. Well, people cheat. They do. And sometimes you can't get by it. You just can't. It can't be helped. That's why I made the point that I had bed check every night, but especially when we got close to fights. Had bed check. Watch what they eat. Proper things, you know. You as a coach, you have to be like a daddy to them sometimes. You know what I mean? That's the way you got to be. That's why, again, you come back to this same sound. Only the strong survive, the weak fall by the wayside. Only two types of fighters, the quick and the dead. You got to be the quick. Hello.
Is there a soft side to you, or are you a disciplinarian?
All right. That's a soft side to me. Yeah, there is, in a sense, but and I know what my job is. And another thing is, I have so much pride in what I do, too. It's behind you. I have so much pride in what I do. I don't never want any of my fighters to lose. And I just work hard at it. And I push them to the next level. And because I'm going to push them above and beyond. And that's that same way I treat my fighters now, the same way. I mean, you have to be disciplinarian in a sense, but yet still, you got to be a person that gets respect for them, and they have to learn to respect you. And that's very important.
Yeah, because some of these kids do come from trauma, and they do need a father figure. They do need a role model. They don't just need to be read the riot act, I guess, right? You need to be soft with them.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Some of them, they don't need that. But as a whole, they like to be disciplined, you know? Some do, some don't.
I was just with Michael Nunn in New York a couple of weeks ago. Tell me about Michael Nunn.
Oh, that's another great, great, great fighter, left-hander, good guy. He was mostly in civilian property most of the time. But I worked with him for a while, and he was a very disciplinarian type guy too, and he moved it to the next level, and he was a hell of a fighter, and we went through some obstacles, but everything was good, and he kind of looked at me sometime and say, he shake his head, but then when it all pushed come to shove, he didn't mind because he wanted to be a winner, and that's what it was about.
So he fought another one of your guys, Frankie Lyles, in Ecuador. Did you work with either of them on that night in Ecuador?
Dang, you know, I guess it's something I can't remember.
No, okay. Because it's interesting.
Maybe I don't want to remember. I don't know.
What was Frankie like? Did you like working with Frankie?
He was another. I like working with him, too. Frank's a... Yeah, good, another good kid. He's like almost like a little different atmosphere with him. He's almost like a son of mine. You know, I can see him now, Coach Adams, and that was him. And I just talked to him about a week ago, as a matter of fact. But now Frankie was a strong disciplinarian, good fighter, tough guy. And you talk about two heck of a fighters. Both of them guys were the same. Both of them were left-handers too. And boy, they could fight. They could fight.
So, you know, you've mentioned about some of these guys that weren't afraid to knuckle down and work hard, but you've also had some guys who were colorful, should we say. We mentioned Corrales. You also worked with Johnny Tapia. Were these guys who were troubled souls while they were training with you? Were they struggling with issues when you worked with them?
In a sense, but thing is, I guess it's because I'm a disciplinarian and I'm a strong, and I have a little motto, and the motto says, my way or the highway, and I push it to the next level. Yes. But the thing is, I want the fighter to be better, and I want him to be better of a fighter and be proud of himself. And, you know, I guess I grew up like that too. I had an auntie who raised me, and she was a strong disciplinarian and would whoop my butt often. As a matter of fact, her role was, take them pants off, boy, and get naked. And she would whoop me with iron straps, and ooh, I just think about them, you know, it was something, but that was life, you know, and of course I wouldn't do that to anybody, but like she was a disciplinarian. She was a tough, tough woman.
Well, talking about your way or the highway, this is why you and Floyd Mayweather Jr. never worked together, right? He didn't like your way or the highway.
No, he didn't. And I explained that to him when the first time we met. And when they did want me to train him, and I said, well, it's going to be my way or the highway. And Floyd, you had to listen to what I say and be disciplinarian to what I say. You run the show, but you don't own the show. So that's the reason why we met and we talked, and I said, well, it ain't gonna work. And I walked away.
Do you think about what might have been, or do you not beat yourself up over that?
Oh, I don't beat myself up over it. I just take it in the stride. You can only do so much and be so many different places. And you just take the guys. And Floyd probably didn't need anybody anyway. He was a disciplinarian within himself, probably. So it really didn't matter, because he had his father there, who was a very technical guy himself. And he had Roger, who I had worked with. Also, I worked with Roger myself, and who was another guy who could box very well. And, you know, he had another brother. He had about three or four brothers that could box and do well. So it wasn't nothing that would affect him now, you know.
Yeah, of course. Now, yeah, there was Jeff Mayweather as well.
If I couldn't say that, pat myself on the back, say he might have been better if I had been reading.
You never know. You never know. Hey, talking about Corrales and Tapia, obviously two wayward characters, you obviously worked with Edwin Valero for a while. How good could Edwin have been?
Oh, he was monstrous anyway, even with the demons that he had. Even the demons that he had. And I'll never forget him, because this is something I don't like to talk too much, say or mention it, but it's... He told me once, he said, Kenny, I said, what? He said, give me a Viagra. I said, what you gonna do? And he used it as a moving to the next level thing. In other words, Viagra would be for lasting a while. And I didn't think of it in that manner at that particular point in time. But that's what it is. It's a lasting thing. So that's what it was about with him. Yeah, but Edwin Valero was one monster's boxer there. He left-handed too. Yes.
What was his power
Venezuela,
like?
Venezuela, huh?
What was his power like?
Oh, man. He had 30 wins, I think, something like that, but like 25 knockouts. So that tells you right there. He could crack.
If you like to call the shots, some of these guys are on their own schedules and do want to do their own things. You got someone like an Edwin Valero, a Johnny Tapia, like they weren't the most reliable guys. So why do they come to you? Do they come to you because they think that you will straighten them out? Is that why they choose you?
You know, it's a possibility. Yeah, I never thought of it in that manner, but it could be the way. I just like to think that I was just a good trainer.
I think you're qualified, right?
Yes.
Is there anyone that didn't achieve what you thought they might achieve? You know, someone that you thought was nailed on for world championships and didn't make it for whatever reason?
Well, you know, if there was, I wouldn't want to talk about him at this point in time in my life or his life either. And I wouldn't want to call a name, but without calling a name, yes, there are some that come to that next level that I was disappointed. Yes, I definitely was. I was definitely disappointed in some of them, but I wouldn't call a name, I'm sorry to say.
What about training heavyweights? Did you enjoy working with the big guys? Obviously, you've worked with the likes of Sam Peter, Michael Bent, Ruslan Chagaev. Did you like working with the bigger guys?
Ray Mercer, yes. It didn't bother me. I wasn't particular about big guys or little guys. But, of course, once again, smaller weights before was more of my repertoire. But heavyweights, I didn't mind either because Hankins years ago, it's just a lot of guys like this that and, you know, they talk about heavy big guys being clumsy or whatever. You try to move them to that next level. I got a good kick out of doing that too, you know. But it didn't matter what weights they were. I didn't really care about the weight class, really.
Do you break your life up into segments when you reflect? Do you think about, you know, the first third of your life was childhood in the army, then it was about the amateurs and amateur boxing, and then it was the pros and the Hall of Fame career that you've had since. Do you break it up like that into those segments?
You know, sometimes I do. You look at your life as it has been, and growing up, where you grew up at, the atmospheres you were around, the people that you had to deal with. I take everything like that into hand, you know, and I don't know, as things really changed, being a disciplinarian and so forth and so on, because I think a lot of it has to do with your upbringing. My aunt, who raised me, was a strong disciplinarian. I got whooped with ironing cards and straps and go give me that stick out there off of that tree and bring it in here. Let me whoop that butt. Hey, all of those things is, listen, I grew up, she didn't play. Put me in the closets. Man, you know, they couldn't do that in this time and day. They wouldn't allow that, you know, but that woman, hey, take them pants out, take them drawers out, get naked, hit me in and everywhere. Yeah, boy, I grew up in a tough lane, but
if you could
make me a better person.
If you could hit any of your fighters with those straps for whatever reason, who would you have wanted to hit with the straps?
It was my little bitty guys. Like, I remember Brian Lennon, Kennedy McKinney, and those two little stars. I like to strap them, you know. Because these guys had so much of their ability, the guys kind of looked up to them. And they would follow suited with sort of suited to them sometime, you know, and they look at me like I'm crazy, you know. So, but you know, what can you say? You know, it's but I had one thing that I did. I put bed check. I put my guys on bed check, and I bring them into the military base, and get me a barracks. I get a barracks being a building, and I have them on bed check, have them in one building, in one room. And they had to do that, guaranteed.
Who were some of the other trainers that you have admired over the years that you've looked up to?
Baron Walker, Pat Nappy, a gentleman named Ed Cole, named Carlton Brooks, Jimmy Grant, Cheryl Dar Morgan, Pat Nappy, Bernie Callahan. Excellent guys.
Kenny, this has been great. It's been a whole lot of fun. And also, I mean, it's just incredible the stuff that you've been through, you know, to have gone through. I mean, the Vietnam stories have blown me away. I mean, they just are incredible. Like, it's a different time, but to have served as you did, I mean, my hat's off to you.
Thank you.
I mean, it's just incredible.
You're doing something for a cause. You know, it's a lot of fighters remind me of people in combat because that's what they do when they get in the ring. But a lot of these guys are very much disciplinarians. Like the gentleman I'm here with now, Paul, he's a disciplinarian. The same thing, a lot of these other guys, Eddie Cook, Kenny McKinney, all these guys were disciplinarians. It's very important to be that way. You know, you in order to move to the next level, you got to be at the point where you got to give up something to get something. So, and that's why it used to be my motto, there are only two types of fighters, the quick and the dead, and you got to be the quick.
Which is
my verbs.
A good way to leave it. But look, I'm really, really grateful for you making the time. I know you've gone over to Nadine's house to do this for me. So thank you so much. It's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much, Kenny. I'm grateful.
Yeah, it is very good. I'm very happy to be able to do this, man. I appreciate it. Hi, Paul. What's up, man?
Oh, there's Paul.
What's up with you, man? Where you chilling? Where you chilling for?
How's Paul doing? Is Paul doing okay?
Yes.
Good.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, good to hear. All right, Kenny. Well, look, I'm going to leave you to it. I'm sure I'll speak to Nadine soon, okay? But thank you for your time.
No, you're welcome, man. I'm very appreciated. If people find out, listen to, and do a good writer behind like you, things should be good. All is good.
Thanks, Kenny. I'm grateful. Take care.
Take care. God bless.
Bye-bye.
So that was great stuff from Kenny. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but I was really entertained and engaged by him throughout. I love an old school boxing trainer, but also a guy who was a pioneer for his time, going back to the late 70s and early 80s. And there aren't many people who do talk about Carlton Brooks, Pat Nappy, Baron Walker, Bernie Callahan and Thomas Boudian as great boxing teachers. They're well worth going back and looking up. Kenny was wonderful. Talking of wonderful, I have partnered with Roots of Fight for the next few weeks and I am giving away an olive Rocky Marciano t-shirt in a size medium this week. You need to tag me into a social media post or message me with the words Kenny Adams and then the two words that he uses to describe the two types of fighters there are out there. And then I'll message you furthermore for details to send out a Roots of Fight t-shirt. This is going to be running for the next few weeks, I'm pleased to say, too. Huge thanks also to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, they will help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance. They are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. Please, if you can, only takes a minute, rate and review this podcast over on iTunes or where you listen to your podcasts. Please share it and spread the word about Boxing Life Stories and get your friends to start going through the archives that we have created. Now we're at episode 230. Huge thanks to you for listening. If you want to support Boxing Life Stories moving forward, jump over onto my Patreon, where I've just done a Patreon evening with those subscribers on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/TrisDixon. It's your way of supporting Boxing Life Stories moving forwards. Huge thanks to you for listening. Huge thanks to Kenny Adams, and we'll be back next week.